It's Tuesday, December 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump is in London, where he will meet with other NATO leaders at their annual meeting, where he has previously said the organization is obsolete.
And frankly, the one that benefits really the least is the United States. We benefit the least. We're helping Europe.
Plus, tomorrow, the next phase of the Democrat-led impeachment inquiry gets underway, and we have a preview of that. And we take a look ahead at the climate summit being held in Madrid, Spain. Those stories and more are all coming up next. United States President Donald Trump said Tuesday France was one of the biggest beneficiaries of NATO after President Emmanuel Macron described the alliance as experiencing brain death.
And frankly, the one that benefits really the least is the United States. We benefit the least. We're helping Europe. Europe unites and they go against a common foe. That may or may not be a foe. Can't tell you that. But there are other foes out there also. But I think nobody needs it more than France. And that's why I think that when France makes a statement like they made about NATO, it's a very dangerous statement for them to make.
Trump, who was in London to attend a NATO leaders meeting to celebrate the organization's 70th birthday, spoke to French President Emmanuel Macron a little later. The discussion between the two leaders was respectful but appeared cooler than it had been in the past. Trump said he was happy to see NATO members increasing their defense spending, but says even more needs to be done to share the alliance's financial burden. Macron said NATO must not be concerned about money, but also needs to refocus itself on new threats.
I'm sorry to say that we don't have the same definition of terrorism around the table. When I look at Turkey, they now are fighting against those who fight with us, who fought with us, shoulder to shoulder against ISIS. And sometimes they work with ISIS proxies. This is an issue, and this is a strategic issue. If we just have discussion about what we pay, and we don't have clear discussions about such a situation, we are not serious. We are not serious for our soldiers, we are not serious for our people.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan will meet with French, British, and German leaders Tuesday as Ankara faces criticism over its military operation into Syria targeting a Kurdish militia. Speaking earlier, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg called Turkey an important ally.
You can just look at the map. Bordering Iraq and Syria, the only ally that borders that part of the world. And Turkey has been enormously important in our joint efforts to fight ISIS, Daesh. We have been able to liberate in the US-led coalition to defeat ISIS all the territory that ISIS controlled just a few months ago, and more than 8 million people that were under ISIS control. And we have done that not least by using infrastructure bases in Turkey. So in the fight against ISIS, Turkey has played a key role.
Dorian Jones reports that Erdogan also wants European support for the millions of Syrian refugees Turkey is hosting.
Syria and the millions of refugees generated by the civil war are expected to top Erdogan's agenda when he meets with British, German and French leaders. According to Erdogan, October's Turkish military operation into Syria against a Kurdish militia is creating an opportunity to send up to 2 million Syrians in Turkey back to territory seized by Turkish forces. Erdogan sees Europe as key to achieving that goal. Erdogan, however, is facing a tough sell in securing European support for his refugee plan. French President Emmanuel Macron has strongly criticized Turkey's military operation against the Syrian Kurds. Ankara is also accused of seeking to change the region's demographics by replacing Kurds with Arabs, an accusation Ankara denies. Erdogan hit back last week, suggesting Macron was brain dead and that Turkey retains powerful leverage over Europe. With Erdogan facing growing domestic pressure to repatriate Syrians and European leaders wary of more refugees, all sides appear to have a powerful incentive to reach a compromise on Tuesday. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
North Korean state media said Tuesday the United States is trying to drag out denuclearization talks ahead of the U.S. presidential election next year and issued a veiled threat to Washington to soften its demands. Ri Tae-song, North Korea's vice foreign minister in charge of U.S. affairs, singled out a U.S. State Department statement calling for sustained and substantial dialogue after North Korea's test of its new multiple rocket launches last week. Negotiations between North Korea and the United States have hit a stalemate after a working-level meeting in October in Stockholm broke down. Iranian state television on Tuesday acknowledged security forces shot and killed what it described as rioters in multiple cities amid recent protests over the rise in government-set gasoline prices, the first time that authorities have offered any sort of accounting for the violence used to put down the demonstrations. Amnesty International says the unrest and crackdown that followed beginning in mid-November killed at least 208 people. An Iranian judiciary official disputed the toll as sheer lies without offering any evidence to support his position. France is threatening a strong European response if the Trump administration follows through on a proposal to hit French cheese, champagne, handbags, and other products with tariffs of up to 100%. The U.S. Trade Representative proposed the tariffs on $2.4 billion in goods Monday in retaliation for a French tax on global tech giants, including Google, Amazon, and Facebook. And while in London, U.S. President Donald Trump said his negotiations with China on a Phase 1 trade deal were going well, and he could make the deal if he wanted to. The U.S. House of Representative Intelligence Committee is expected to publicly release Tuesday a report on its findings and recommendations in the impeachment inquiry into U.S. President Donald Trump. Committee Chairman Adam Schiff told MSNBC late Monday that the panel was putting the finishing touches on that report. He also said the committee would vote Tuesday night on formally submitting it to the Judiciary Committee, whose members will decide whether or not to draw up articles of impeachment against the president. The Judiciary Committee is scheduled to start its own impeachment hearings on Wednesday and will do so without a Trump lawyer present. Now joining us on the phone to help break everything down is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, welcome to the program.
You're so welcome.
So we have this forthcoming report from the Intelligence Committee in the House. What do we know about it, and why are they having a vote scheduled later this evening?
Right. So think of this report as kind of a summing up of the last 2 months of work that the House Intelligence Committee has done in this impeachment inquiry. And really, we won't expect to see too much new news come out of it because it's summing up all of the closed-door depositions and the public hearings, which, of course, we've already seen and read. Now, there may be a couple of new recommendations to the House Judiciary Committee because, as we know, this is kind of a handoff week. The House Intelligence Committee is handing off the impeachment inquiry responsibilities to House Judiciary Chairman Jerry Nadler, who will, of course, take that over tomorrow morning when they start their public hearing.
As things move over to the Judiciary Committee, which is the traditional home of where things begin in the impeachment process in the United States, what is the hearing tomorrow going to look like, and what are they trying to do on this first outing?
So think of this in a way that it's almost the House Intelligence Committee gathered the evidence. They're voting on it tonight to pass it out of their committee. That's kind of a House of Representatives formal procedure. Then they hand it off to the Judiciary Committee, who won't really be gathering any new evidence. What they're tasked with doing is deciding whether that evidence merits impeachment. They have to look at impeachable offenses. They'll be using a panel of constitutional law experts to discuss this issue, and that will help guide them as they decide whether or not to write up articles of impeachment.
And thus far, the White House has said it will not participate in this week's hearing on Wednesday. They have been given a Friday deadline on whether or not they're going to appear in any forthcoming ones. What have Democrats and Republicans said on the Hill regarding that?
Right. So I don't think it came as a huge surprise that President Trump and his legal counsel would not be participating in Wednesday's hearing. That's been the approach of House Republicans all along, that this procedure, this whole process is illegitimate. And President Trump, of course, himself has called it a hoax. He's mentioned that he feels much more comfortable once impeachment, which, of course, is a two-step process, move to the U.S. Senate for a trial. And he even said today that he would be willing to participate at that point. But he clearly sees this House Democratic-led procedure as illegitimate.
Catherine Gibson reports for VOA from the Capitol Hill. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You're so welcome.
Iraqi security officials say anti-government protesters have surrounded a key shrine in the southern city of Najaf amid concerns of a new outbreak of violence. Tuesday's demonstration comes after a rare day of calm following weeks of bloodshed across Iraq. A police official in Najaf says the gathered protesters are demanding that influential Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr help them enter and symbolically take control of the shrine. You're listening to VOA News.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the International Day for the Disabled Persons is commemorated on December 3rd. Disability on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
On December 6th, Border Crossings will bring you the greatest songs inspired by the soul genre. You'll hear smash hits from Three Dog Night, Holland Oates, and George Michael. If you like these tracks, you'll love our Soul Inspirations theme. December 6th on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam denounced U.S. legislation protecting human rights in the embattled city after it was passed last week. That comes after Beijing banned official U.S. military visits to the city. Reuters' Jason Albano has more.
Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam issued stern opposition on Tuesday against the U.S. law supporting anti-government protesters in the city.
We are totally against it. We don't see any need for this proposed law and we don't see any justification for it. Human rights and freedoms are protected by the basic law here in Hong Kong. In fact, I would like to ask, in which way have the freedoms of Hong Kong actually been undermined?
Her statements followed Beijing's announcement Monday that it would ban military aircraft and ships from coming to Hong Kong. It comes after Beijing said the U.S. was allegedly encouraging anti-government protesters to commit violent acts. A spokeswoman for China's foreign ministry said on Monday Beijing would also slap sanctions against certain American NGOs, including Human Rights Watch.
We will issue sanctions against NGOs which have displayed despicable behavior in Hong Kong as the city deals with unrest.
U.S. President Donald Trump signed the legislation last week as Hong Kong dealt with unrest for its sixth month. President Trump admitted the law could fracture ties between the U.S. and China, who are in the midst of trade negotiations. He said the law doesn't make it better, but added that he thought Beijing would still be interested in reaching a deal.
That was reporter Jason Albano from Reuters News. Carrie Lam also announced a fourth round of relief measures to boost the city's battered economy. She did not specify what additional measures would be taken to boost the economic activity, saying details would be announced in the near term. The government has previously offered about $2.7 billion in support to the economy, particularly the transport, tourism, and retail sectors. The unrest has hammered retail sales, which fell by their steepest on record in October as protests scared off tourists and hit spending. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned on Monday that governments risk sleepwalking past a point of no return as governments prepare to gather in Madrid for the latest round of annual negotiations to bolster the 2015 Paris Agreement to curb global warming. It comes against the backdrop of unusually severe weather disasters this year, from fires in the Arctic, Amazon, and Australia to intense tropical hurricanes. International Edition's Lori London spoke with Stephen Lewandowski, a scientist and professor with the University of Bristol, who will lead a panel at the Madrid summit. She began their conversations about the clash between the warnings that emissions are going up, when they need to go down, young people outside of the summit who are demanding action, and the politicians tasked with making those big changes.
There is a major gap between the political reality and the physical reality. And I think it's going to be difficult, but not impossible, to reduce that gap.
Secretary General Antonio Guterres said there's also a real gap between the world's major emitters and those that will suffer the most because of it. And those people that are the most emitters really need to step up. It doesn't seem like that's happening. And of course, we know the United States is not leading the way.
No, on the contrary, I think the U.S. is in the impediment to progress at the moment, unfortunately, yeah.
Would you say that's because the U.S. president has pulled out of the climate accord and has actually started the actual process of doing that?
That's the most obvious manifestation of that. But I think, you know, there's a lot more stuff domestically that's going on, you know, such as the undermining of the independence of the EPA and all sorts of appointments within the U.S. government into key positions of people who are beholden to commercial interests, to say the least, and who are not supporting the scientific consensus on climate change.
And under the existing pledges, will the world continue to be on course for the kind of temperature rises that are threatening the stability of these very societies they're trying to bolster?
Number one, we're on a very dangerous trajectory. Number two, the progress in terms of technology and the potential to replace fossil fuels is actually considerable. So we're sort of doing the bad things politically while ignoring good things that we could do technologically, which is unfortunate to say the least and bizarre. But the good news is if we ever do get serious about it, then I think we can move surprisingly quickly.
When you say if we ever do,
I think we just need to achieve a global political consensus on this, and that has to include the United States, because the United States is a major emitter, and we need concerted policy action on that. And I think at the moment the difficulty is that everybody is sort of waiting for everybody else, and no one feels that they should move ahead, and they're all pointing the finger at each other. So we have an impasse that has to be broken.
UN chief saying we're getting closer to the point of no return. When you hear things like that, you get pretty scared.
Undoubtedly, there are reasons to be very concerned, and we do know that complex systems contain nasty surprises. And whether you're talking about climate change or anything else that's hyper-complex, once you start poking it with a stick, the outcome is never good, because it can contain unanticipated tipping points and feedback loops and all sorts of things.
We mentioned the president. He and his administration, the people that he seems to be, as you mentioned, bringing into these agencies that are tasked with protecting the planet, denies the science, and it doesn't really matter what the scientists say. People are taken aback by that.
Sure.
Wondering how you can get to that point where you just don't believe the consensus, yeah, the science, etc. And you're actually speaking on this very topic at a panel. What is the answer to that? Why is this that people get to this point where they just don't believe?
Excellent question. That is precisely what we have to look at. We have to look at this in a broader context, because it isn't just climate denial. It is also the case that Donald Trump, according to fact checkers, has made more than 11,000 misleading or false statements since he took office. So why or how is it possible for that to happen and without there being a public backlash? I think that's the real question we have to understand. We think, on the basis of the available evidence, that the answer is that whenever people, a segment of the population, feels either disenfranchised or left behind or feels that the political system is not working in their favor, then they accept what we call a lying demagogue. That is, they're accepting people who pretend or proclaim to be acting on their behalf against the establishment. And once they feel that somebody is opposing the establishment, then any violation of establishment norms is seen as an asset rather than a problem. So one of the striking things about Donald Trump, and also in the UK, is the complete disregard for truth and the complete sort of insouciance when they get caught out. It's kind of like they don't even take notice of being caught out and just continue on in the same vein. They can only do that because that is signaling to their supporters that they're violating establishment norms and that therefore they're on the side of quote-unquote the real people against the establishment. establishment. So that is really the political situation that we have to understand. And I think that explains why Donald Trump keeps on making false statements. It explains why he can pull out of the climate accord and a lot of people don't care. It explains why a lot of people don't believe climate scientists, because scientists are part of the elite, quote unquote. And that is, I think, the problem we're encountering now.
And that was Stefan Lewandowski, a scientist and professor with the University of Bristol, speaking to our own Lori London. Meanwhile, Greta Thunberg, the Swedish activist, has docked in Lisbon after a 20-day crossing from New York. Her boat, the Lavagbond, carried the activist, who refuses to travel by plane, across the Atlantic Ocean so she could attend the COP25 climate summit. Thunberg will spend the day holding meetings with Portuguese climate activists and resting before her departure for Madrid. Speaking at a press conference ahead of the COP25 summit, Petri Talas, the Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, says that while the final numbers aren't in yet for 2019, this year looks to be the warmest year on record. But all hope is not lost.
There's growing amount of renewable energy used in many parts of the world. And if you look at the car industry, it's growing amount of electric vehicles and the biofuel vehicles that are coming into the market. So the world is moving, and this problem is understood, but so far the ambition level hasn't been high enough to reach the Paris targets. But there's no reason to be totally pessimistic that nothing is happening. I think that things are happening, but so far the ambition level hasn't been high enough.
In addition, the Chilean Minister for Science and Technology added that not only governments need to listen to the science, the private sector and the civil community also need to be involved in finding relevant solutions. An online site raising money to help koalas displaced and injured in Australia's brush fire crisis has become one of the country's most successful charity campaigns. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has that story.
An animal hospital in New South Wales set up the GoFundMe online campaign with a target of $17,000 to buy automatic drinking stations for distressed koalas. It has, though, raised more than $1.2 million. Donations have come from around the world, including the US, Britain, New Zealand and Germany. Much of the interest in the facility at Port Macquarie, north of Sydney, came after the dramatic rescue of a koala from charred bushland was captured on video. The marsupial, who was later called Lewis, was picked up by a grandmother who ran through the flames to rescue the badly burnt marsupial. Footage of the rescue was widely viewed on social and traditional media. Lewis was treated for his wounds, but they were so severe he couldn't be saved. Sue Ashton, the president of the Port Macquarie Koala Hospital, says the fundraising effort has been incredible.
Absolutely overwhelmed. We had no idea that it would generate so much interest. And for the Koala Hospital, it's been absolutely wonderful. But also for koalas, I think it's really brought them front and centre, and they deserve to be. They're just wonderful little creatures.
Dozens of koalas have been brought to the hospital for treatment since the fire crisis began. Blazes continue to burn across eastern Australia. Six people have died and hundreds of homes have been destroyed since the emergency began in November. The impact on wildlife is unknown, but vast areas of habitat have been scorched. Officials fear the toll on native flora and fauna will be immense. Australians have also donated to those who've lost property, but some experts believe that the huge amounts pledged to the Koala Hospital reflect broader concerns about the impact of the fires on the natural environment. The Koala fundraising effort was launched last month and is now the biggest GoFundMe campaign in Australia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And one final note on the way out the door, the creators of the popular video Baby Shark are looking to translate the song into the Native American language of Navajo. The Pink Fong subsidiary of a South Korean company is starting to hire voice actors for that project. look for it to come sometime in the near future. And on that note, it's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, engineer Sidrak Franklin, and managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, thank you very much for joining us. Don't forget, you can keep abreast of all the world events and news on our website. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.